versus BronyCons, which I would say also contain their own unique branch. So in general, I'll be talking about conventions based on their genres. So anime, furry, science fiction, fantasy, gaming, comics, and multimedia would be the basically a hybrid of all these different cons. Two fandoms will get a special shout out, the Star Trek fandom and the My Little Pony fandom, because the types of cons that the bronies and Trekkies brought on the scene did change the game for a lot of things. So those are the only two fandom specific cons I'm going to kind of talk a bit at that level. So let's go to this main slide here. This is a more worked out version of my con history tree with Worldcon as the root. Now, for the first, so I kind of use Worldcon as a starting point, but of course, any old guard science fiction person will know that there is a contention for what is considered the first convention, Philcon, which actually are part of Anthrocon's own roots, and the Leeds Convention in the United Kingdom. But I will make an argument why I would say Worldcon should be considered the main trunk, since a lot of the techniques that we use from modern-day con running come from what was developed within Worldcon. And I also will say science fiction con, comic cons will have their own other branch. And the issue is trying to define what a convention is, because is a Renaissance Fair a convention? How about just a regular author book signing? How about a random club meetup? So to basically give a definition of the convention, I'm basically making Worldcon kind of the default baseline of what we can use to measure all other conventions by. So basically every other con that uses the Worldcon model, I will say at least fits the definition of convention with my book. All right, so let's begin. Let's start 80 years ago, back during the golden age of science fiction and the golden age of comics. Coincidentally, both the golden age of science fiction and the golden age of comics can date themselves to 1938. That year, Action Comics, which was the first published appearance of Superman, was on board. And that was also the year a lot of the big science fiction anthology magazines started to get published. Now, Golden Age of Science Fiction, you have to think about from a holistic model. We have to think about the time period that these conventions started to take place in. So when we look at the Golden Age of Science Fiction, it came from the result of two decades of horror. We had the First Great World War. We had the Spanish flu. So coincidentally, we're in a pandemic now. I would say that the Spanish flu had a big impact on how the pulp genre was shaped around this time. And of course, we had the Great Depression. Now, at the tail end of the 1930s, the Great Depression was lifting up. So we have a period of people finally being able to make income and wanting to, you know, go back, go out and start meeting with people again. Now, normally when I talk about this, when I start this panel, I go all the way back to the Victorian era. But right now we're just going to go straight to the 1930s. But I will say a lot of the early fan meetups that we have kind of take the roots from the literary circles of the Victorian era. This is where we have the Jane Austen fandom, the Sherlock Holmes fandom. A lot of pulp fandoms and story fandoms started to get the roots in the Victorian era. This would come in the form of middle-class people finally being able to access arts that were reserved for the upper class. So pulp magazines, operas were now cheaper. This was also the time when film started becoming seen as a new artistic expression. Before then, because printing was so expensive, because writing a book by hand was expensive, because operas were only for the upper class, most of the stories that we had were specifically written for the upper class in mind. With the middle class now booming during the Industrial Revolution, a lot of the stories now shifted to focusing on the middle and lower classes who are now able to afford these works. Along with that, we had in-person club meetings, author signings, and most importantly, we had the what's known as the fanzine, where fans will basically publish a zine where they'll collect letters from one another. And it was kind of like the basically the web forms of the Victorian era, where fans would write to each other in these fanzines, debate over canon, debate over theories. Like if they had a theory on the Sherlock Holmes stories, they will be debating and writing and to each other through these fanzines. Now, these types of fanzines and meetings really, really got big during this period. And of course, it died down during the Spanish flu and Great Depression, and started picking up towards the tailwind of this period when science fiction was really starting to make its height. So when these science fiction fans decided to gather with each other, they're like, come on, let's make a bigger fan group. Let's make a bigger fan meeting. Normally, the fan meetings will come about by author signings. Normally, an author will come to a bookstore for a day. He'll do a few signings. Fans will gather there for an hour, wait in line for an autograph, and then hang out in the bookstore and chat for a few hours. Why don't we make this a day? So we have PhilCon and an event in London, in Leeds, basically trying to organize a larger type of convention. But these were one-day events and normally only made up the local people from the area. So when we have WorldCon coming about in 1939, I will say WorldCon was unique in the sense in that instead of being held as a one-day meeting of fans, it was held over the course of a weekend. In fact, it was held over July 4th weekend, like AfroCon is now is currently being held over. And the fact that these early WorldCon attendees decide to rent a hotel out collectively, hang out with each other over a course of 3 days, I will say kind of cements what every single con will become afterwards. This wasn't a one-day event where you travel into town, hang out with friends for a few hours, and travel out of town. This was an event that you stayed for the entire weekend. So this is where we have the interaction between fans and the industry. Now, beforehand, you basically would meet your favorite authors or artists during author signings, and it was kind of cold and interpersonal. Now that the authors and artists that these science fiction fans were loving were staying in the same hotel as them, they will mingle with them at the bar, they'll see them in the hallway, they'll sit down in an empty room and just chat with them for a few hours. You have this unique connection between the fans and the folks from the industry. With WorldCon, they normally would always have a bunch of quote-unquote industry folks there, because if you think about it, the folks who were in the science fiction industry were science fiction fans themselves, and vice versa. So to basically single out as kind of like a good honor, so kind of like a lifetime achievement award, WorldCon and every WorldCon since will basically have one industry folk that would be honored as their guest of honor. Then later they will eventually have a fan guest of honor to honor the fandom, and then they would also have a ghost of honor decades down the line to honor deceased people. Now, the first WorldCon, like I said, held over July 4th weekend, held in the hotel, it had about 200 guests, so really, really good start. Now, a lot of the things that this first WorldCon and the later WorldCons started to do were cement some of the early elements that we'll see common with every con now. So things that we kind of take for granted now, like the con badge and the lanyards and the ribbons to put on the con badge. Like, these are all stuff that were developed in these early WorldCons. Room parties will especially become very, very big, and I'll get into why room parties are important later on. But we start to see the early elements of programming when we have authors doing talks. And we had the early elements of the dealer's hall and the artist alley with publishers, you know, wanting just to sell a few books, artists went selling their paintings in an art show style, authors just sitting at empty tables offering to sign their books, and of course fans of science fiction media who would sell props from, you know, their favorite science fiction movies or shows that they had there. This is also where we kind of get the first cosplay. Forrest Ackerman, who was a publisher and editor for a lot of these science fiction magazines in this day, Forrest Ackerman likes to claim that he was the first person to implement cosplay, dressing up as a science fiction character with his girlfriend at the very first Worldcon. Forrest Ackerman was the editor for a lot of science fiction authors like L. Ron Hubbard and some other folks, and he kind of cements a lot of this early history with this early science fiction fandom and the early science fiction cons. Now, we have Worldcon introducing a lot of elements that we'll see taken up by later cons. Now, what's interesting about Worldcon, if you guys have never been to a Worldcon before, I think you guys should know, especially furries. Furries and science fiction fandom seem very, very tight, but Worldcon itself is kind of held Olympic style, World's Fair style. It's hosted by a different science fiction club in a different city every year, which when we think about it, it's kind of unheard of now. Most cons that we have, most large cons, are situated in one city. It's held by the same board. It's kind of run by the same core staff year after year. So the fact that a convention can be hosted by the different science fiction clubs, essentially, you know, handing the torch to the next city, is very, very unique, and it's still very interesting today because Worldcon is a, you know, is a trademark, but it's not really owned by any one entity or organization. The Hugo Awards, which are part of Worldcon, there's a lot of trust that they pass this shared history of Worldcon from one con to another. Now, Worldcon could be held in any city around the world, but mostly in these early days, it's held in America. But to ensure that there would always be a science fiction convention in North America, we had WesterCon form 10 years later. WesterCon specifically was meant as a science fiction con to take place in America. And then it led to the next con, Midwest Con, the following year, which is the first Relaxicon. So Relaxicons are now not normally a thing in the convention scene, but Relaxicon is basically a convention where there is no programming, essentially. It's just a giant meetup. But what's interesting about these Relaxicons are so rooms that would normally be reserved for panel rooms were just kind of left open for, you know, random fans to gather and talk about what they want. So in these early days, let's say you were a fan of Flash Gordon, for example, a lot of Flash Gordon fans might find an empty panel room and just sit and talk about that. Now, what's interesting is since these were held in hotels, normally these hotels would have a random piano in the lobby, so people would go around these panels and start singing and, you know, making songs. And eventually these fans would start singing songs about their favorite science fiction properties. And sometimes these fans would bring a guitar into these conventions and find an empty panel room and just sit with their guitar and start making up songs about their favorite science fiction stories. And this is where we get the birth of convention music. This early convention music is called folk music. It was a typo. It was supposed to be folk music, but it was a typo in one of the con books, but the name kind of stuck. And these, basically, if you've ever been to a rave at a convention, if you've ever seen the hallway DJ randomly set up at an anime con, if you've ever been to a brony convention, just saw a bunch of bronies, making EDM music in the corner. If you ever been to, you know, a furry con with a piano in the lobby and people just start, you know, playing songs there. That's kind of got its roots from these early folk musicians at these cons. Now, what's very interesting is when people realize how important, folk got started from a typo, funny enough. Now, this is where we get the start of the Hugo Awards. And what's interesting is the Hugo Awards are like the Oscars, the Academy Awards of the science fiction genre. The Hugo Awards are the most prestigious awards for the science fiction literary scene. What's unique about the Hugo Awards is that it's voted on by the fans, by the attendees of the convention. So the only people who could vote for the Hugo Awards year after year are the attendees of Worldcon. And that gives the convention attendees big power within the industry, especially the science fiction industry during this period. And once people realize, oh, wait, it's the convention attendees who get to decide who wins the Hugo Awards, that's when the industry starts slowly paying attention to the convention scene as they would grow. Now, after World War II, we have a period where a lot of people were not happy. A lot of vets were coming back from the war. A lot of them were shell-shocked, and they want to delve into escapism. Because of this, you start to see a shift in both the science fiction industry and the comic book industry. Here, science fiction, which we retroactively call the speculative fiction genre, splits into hardcore science fiction and fantasy. So the division is greatly described in Michael Moorcock's essay called Epic Pooh, where he compares the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, The Hobbit, and Lord of the Rings to essentially being Winnie the Pooh stories, safe escapist, feel-good adventure stories where the good guy always wins. Tolkien's works basically shifted the fantasy genre from sword and sorcery to more what's known as epic fantasy or high fantasy. It was a more escapist route. The world sucks. Let's have a fun escapist story where, yeah, there's some adventures, but the good guy will always win at the end of the day. Michael Moorcock did not like this and countered it with his work, specifically his magazine that he helped edit called New Wave Science Fiction. New Wave Science Fiction was a counter to the Golden Age science fiction. Golden Age science fiction, comic book author Alan Moore basically called Cowboys in Space. It was bright, happy, optimistic, basically happy, optimistic colonialism in space, where mankind was out there conquering the stars. New Wave science fiction was like, no, look, we have pollution, we have racism, we have classism, we have poverty, we have a lot of issues we as humanity need to deal with today. So if we're ever going to go out and conquer the stars, we need to wake people up. And thus new wave science fiction and these new wave of hardcore science fiction authors started to shift their stories more towards dystopian, dark, grim, gritty stories where the reality of the future wasn't golden and happy. The reality of the future was dark, dystopian. And if we didn't wake up to the realities of the world, it's going to stay that way. And so this is where we see the shift in speculative fiction to high fantasy and hardcore science fiction. In the comic book industry, we see a shift to what's now known as the Silver Age of comics. DC with the Flash of Two Worlds and Marvel with the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man, both DC and Marvel publishing their works in 1961. And this is where we start to see a boom in the comics industry. Now, the first comic convention is New York Comic Con. No connection to the current Repop New York Comic Con of today. The New York Comic Convention kind of had its roots from a different angle. So the science fiction convention scene, like I said, Worldcon, these early science fiction cons were essentially founded by fans who wanted to honor and interact with the industry, essentially fans inviting the industry into their abode. New York, these early comic cons were essentially, you could say, were, you know, comic book stores and dealers who wanted to sell a lot of their old comic book collectibles, their old comic books, and they needed a place to sell their comics. So they basically devised these flea market style stalls at in spaces like school gymnasiums, hotel convention centers, and lobbies, and start to sell. There were basically places where comic book dealers could sell their works. And like science fiction cons having a guest of honor, comic book cons want to attract people to their event by inviting folks from the industry. The issue was there's a lot of people in the comic book industry. No one of them would be enough to attract people. And they didn't want to pay to fly all these comic book industry people out. That would cost a lot of money. So what did they do? They devised an interesting concept called the Artist Alley. Hey, artists, come vent at our convention and you can make money. You could sell your art. You could do signings. You could sell your original prints. You could do commissions. And we'll put your name on our flyer and promote you. And hey, you can make money on the side. So it was interesting because it was a way to invite quote-unquote guests of honors to come to their con to get extra promotion without having to pay them as guests of honors. So Comic-Con started from a more industry route where, as opposed to science fiction cons, which are started by fans, a Comic-Con seemed to be started by the dealers and industry folks who want to attract fans into their vault. Now, this is where Comic-Cons introduced the concept of the Artist Alley. Now, I want to point out that the Comic-Con Artist Alley is going to be very, very different from the AnimeCon Artist Alleys that are going to evolve later down the line. But the Comic-Con Artist Alley were intended for these industry artists to attract people to their convention. And this is also where we get the division between an Artist Alley and a Dealer's Hall. Before then, the Dealer's Hall and the Artist Alley were kind of considered one nebulous vendor's hall, but now we start seeing a division between the two. And of course, the next important one that got started was Golden State Comic-Con, which eventually became San Diego Comic-Con. Now, this was a period that also saw a boom in the indie comic scene. So if you guys don't know too much about the story, in Marvel, Stan Lee kind of took the credit for almost everything that his co-creators, Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko, created. And because of that, Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko got kind of upset with the industry and left Marvel Comics. And a lot of comic book artists followed suit and started to work on their own independent comics, starting their own independent press. Now, in the 60s, along with the counterculture movement, we started seeing a comic counterculture movement, underground comics, specifically in Austin, Texas, and San Francisco, where we started to see the birth of a lot of what we now know as fanzines. These were short little cheaply printed Xerox comics. Of course, one of the leaders of this of the underground comic scene during this period was Robert Crumb, who made Fritz the Cat. I'm sure a lot of old school furries will know about Fritz the Cat. And we do start to see the birth of a lot of anthropomorphic comics during the underground comic movement. And the other groups that were very important were the Air Pirates, a group of publishers who started to publish their own parody comics that featured Mickey Mouse, and kind of poked fun at Disney and consumer capitalism, and basically had Mickey and Minnie doing very adult things like doing drugs and having sex. And of course, it got sued by Disney. And this is where, because beforehand, you could kind of publish your own Superman comic, and copyright laws were so loose at the time, you could get away with it. After Disney stepped in with the Air Pirates, that kind of changed the game. But this gave way to an interesting underground comic movement. Now, what's funny enough, Japan also had its own underground comic movement around this time period. And Japan's underground comic movement was so big, they started to develop their own circles. These it eventually developed what's known as Dondinshi culture, or the Dondinshi circles. Dondinshis were very similar to the Tijuana Bibles of the 1920s, where they'll take popular anime and manga characters and do their own little short 10, 20-page mangas about them. 90% of them are not safe for work porn art, so that's always been a thing with the convention fanzines, where people would mostly make not safe for work stuff. But these Dondinshi circles started to gather in similar ways in hotels and convention centers, and eventually became so big, they essentially started to give birth to their own unique type of artist alleys. This is where we get the birth of Comic-Con. Comic-Con is still the largest convention in the world. It is 3 times bigger than San Diego Comic-Con. It's held twice a year, and Comic-Con is essentially just one giant artist alley. That's it. Really no panels, no industry announcements, no guests, just one giant artist alley that's 3 times bigger than San Diego Comic-Con. And this is where we get the birth of the AnimeCon style artist alley, which will eventually make its way over to America. Now, this is where we're going to focus on next, during the 1970s with the rise of the Star Trek fandom, because this is where we're going to see an interesting change. This is where I branch off the fancy cons into their own subcategory, because fancy cons kind of become very different from the mainstream conventions. And this is where science fiction cons become general conventions with the help of the Star Trek fandom. Now, as we know, the Star Trek fandom was the Star Trek show was announced by Gene Roddenberry at Worldcon. These industry realizing the importance of appealing to the convention goers started making announcements at conventions. So we kind of see, you know, Marvel and Disney making announcements at Comic-Con now. Well, a smaller version of this started during the 1970s. And it must have appealed very right, because boom, we had the birth of the Star Trek fandom. Trekkies became really, really big. And the Star Trek fans decided, why not host our own convention? So Star Trek hosted its first convention, Star Trek Lives, which had a 3,000 attendees for its first year. That's actually really impressive, because, you know, it's hard for some cons to still even reach 3,000 attendees now. 6,000 attendees its second year. 15,000 attendees its third year. And 6,000 attendees had to be turned away. Now, this is interesting, because this is where a new innovation in the convention running scene came about. So before then, we only had one panel at a time. There's normally only one panel room, and you had one panel back to back, and all the attendees of the con will normally go sit in that one panel. After a panel over, we'll leave, take a 15-minute break, then go back and watch another panel. Because of the rise of the Star Trek fandom, a lot of these science fiction con panels would start to be filled with a lot of Star Trek panels. And a lot of old school, old guard science fiction fans didn't care about Star Trek. What's this new hipster thing that these kids like? Nah, I don't want to see Star Trek. So a lot of Star Trek panels would turn away a lot of the older science fiction fans who now didn't have a panel to go to. Here's an interesting idea. What if we ran more than one panel at the same time? I'm surprised it took them 40 years to finally realize this, but boom, we got the birth of multi-track programming where, hey, we could run panels simultaneously. And instead of everyone going to one panel, they could choose which panel they go to. So I'm surprised it took them 40 years to come to this bright idea, but boom, the Star Trek fandom and convention started. And thus, multi-track programming was born. So now you can have a track completely dedicated to Star Trek panels, and some for other science fiction stuff. Now, the Star Trek fandom brought a lot of interesting things that we see popularize the tropes and stereotypes of fandoms. So Star Trek fandom really went hard on cosplay. And because Star Trek is a visual medium, you could actually have accurate cosplay, as opposed to the early science fiction fans who were making their cosplay based on what they read in the stories or based on covers of the books. The Star Trek fandom now had a visual source to base its cosplays off of. Slash fiction pairing became a thing. Again, not a new thing. People were shipping Greek gods back in the day, so shipping was not new. What's interesting about shipping in the Star Trek fandom is it took two canonically straight characters, Kirk and Spock, and made them in a gay romantic relationship. So this is where you start seeing a lot of females being involved with the convention scene through creative outlets, through shipping and fanzines. And it's also where we see a big boom in the LGBT culture in the convention scene. Now, I think someone in chat mentioned CreationCon, and I think this is a good time to mention CreationCon. CreationCon, I would say, is technically the first of what I will call the pro cons. Old guard people call them cattle cons, but these are the cold, sterile, professionally run cons, specifically meant to make money, as opposed to the freeform volunteer conventions of the past. CreationCon started the first of the pro cons, but the pro cons won't really get started until the 90s. But we start to see a lot of things that we kind of take for granted in cons now, born during this period. So the term gopher was coined for a con volunteer. And we started to have the formation of con security forces. So if you guys ever been to a convention in the San Francisco Bay Area, most likely the security for your con, whether it's a furry con or a brony con or a sci-fi con, are normally always flare. So we start to see a lot of stuff that we take for granted in the convention volunteer scene. We start to see form in the 70s and 80s as these cons start to grow and grow and grow. And this is where we kind of get the formation of what's known as general cons, because you have to think about it. The speculative fiction scene, the science fiction scene from the 30s to the 70s at this point were general. When you said science fiction, it included everything: fantasy, sword and sorcery, rocket ship stories. It included superheroes. It included anthropomorphic characters. It included cartoons. It included what anime was known at that time, Japanimation. So science fiction was a catch-all term for all media. Now that science fiction was slowly becoming defined as a specific genre, a lot of these old science fiction cons started to rebrand themselves as general conventions, essentially not really much of a change aside from science fiction cons who want to stay hardcore SF started to create their own branch, and a lot of people who wanted to focus on whatever was general and popular in the media at the time start to do what's now known as either multimedia cons or general conventions. Now, okay, it looks like, 40 minutes and I'm not even halfway through a panel, so I'm going to try to speed up, so sorry about that. So let's talk about the room parties that gave birth to the anime and furry cons. Room parties are very important. I'm sure you guys have been to a furry con. If you guys ever been to a science fiction con, you'll notice something very interesting at both science fiction cons and furry cons. So, like I said, science fiction cons used to be the general cons at the time. So how can fans of Doctor Who, they go to a world con. Well, how do they meet up with other Doctor Who fans? Well, they would normally put what's known as a bulletin board in the lobby of the hotel. We'll have a bulletin board. And the bulletin board, you could either write a room number and a description. So something might say, Doctor Who fans, come meet in Hilton 502 at 8 p.m. tonight. So to meet with specific fandoms in these general conventions and early science fiction cons, they would start to form room parties, and these room parties would be advertised on bulletin boards in the lobby. Now, two type of room parties started to become very, very big around this time. You had room parties for Japanimation, which we now know as anime, and room parties for anthropomorphic animals, which I'll cover at right after the anime scene. But let's talk about anime. Now, anime started to boom in the 90s, specifically in the mid-90s when Dragon Ball Z and Sailor Moon were redubbed and Pokemon were redubbed. You started to see a big boom in anime fandom in America. Now, what's interesting is the anime conventions started to form from three different areas. First, you had the science fiction con room parties. Second, you had the university cons. And third, you had that big convention, Comic Con. So Yamotacon, a lot of people want to say is the first anime con. It was in 1938. It was a one-day university meetup, so I don't specifically consider that a con by the World Con model of defining cons, AE Con. I will say is the first anime con in America specifically, since it did the model 3 days at a hotel, rented hotel space, panels, industry guests, all that. Now, anime cons started to implement the Comic Con style of the Artist Alley. So while the Comic Cons Artist Alley were focused on industry professional artists who were working on licensed comics, the Anime Con Artist Alleys were specifically aimed towards fan artists selling fan art, which, of course, due to the legal issues in America. So Anime Cons really had a very different style of an artist alley being developed around this time. And Anime Cons brought something new to the mix. So while you had folk music at science fiction cons and Comic Cons, even to this day, there's no music at Comic Cons, Anime Cons in Japan were really big on raves, concerts, and costume parties or masquerade balls, which were imported to the American anime convention scene. So American anime cons were really the first to implement concerts at the convention. So you had the Japanese style of concert and raves being implemented at these early anime cons. And this is where I guess a lot of you guys come in, the furries. So I'm sure a lot of you guys know it better than me, and you'll be correcting me since I wasn't there. But let's talk about the state of what we now know as the furry fandom around this time. So it's interesting because anthropomorphic art has been around as old as human history. A lot of our first artwork were anthropomorphic characters. Anthropomorphic characters featured in mythology, fables, and legends for a long time. And everyone growing up always had a favorite cartoon character, a favorite Disney character, a favorite cereal mascot, a favorite high school sports team mascot. So anthropomorphic animals have been with us for a long time. So why is it that furries seem to be a weird niche subsection of culture, when in reality, furries should be the most general and accepted fandom of all of them? It's the most accessible. It's the one that almost everyone partakes in, whether they know it or not. Okay, well, I guess fireworks are being outside. Hopefully the fireworks aren't coming through. So we have anthropomorphic art, like I said, started to be formed from these early, the early comic zine culture. I don't want to name, I'm sure you guys could name your favorite furry zine from this period. I don't want to go over all of them, but you start to see focus on anthropomorphic animals, and there wasn't really a name for around the time. The first room parties at these world cons and science fiction cons were just, you know, anthropomorphic, you know, animal fans. The term furry wasn't even coined, but like the anime room parties, which started to overflow, these anthropomorphic room parties also start to overflow to the point where they start to think, hey, we could actually be big enough to host our Earth First convention. So these early furry room parties, you know, were like, hey, yeah, we could host our own con. And you guys probably know Conference was founded in 1989, the first furry con. And what's interesting about Conference is it adapted the science fiction con model for running cons. So while anime cons and comic cons took some elements from the science fiction con scene, the furry cons basically continued the science fiction model. So you had the room parties, you had the bulletin board in the lobby, you had the reduced hotel rate model, you had the multi-track programming, you had focus on the room parties. So that's why most furry cons now still have the bulletin board in the lobby for the room parties. It even took the art shows. You only see art shows at science fiction cons and furry cons now. You don't see this at any other type of con. So a lot of the elements that the science fiction cons kept, the furry cons carried over to their conventions. Now, in the 70s, when the Trekkies came about, this was the birth of local media. So what did local media do? Hey, we don't have any news to report on. Oh, there's a Star Trek convention happening in town. Okay, let's go report on them. Local media would say, oh, weird people dressed up in funny costumes. These are crazy people. Let's record them. And we get the stereotypical image being formed about conventions because of how the media from the 70s would portray these Star Trek fans. So instead of talking about the interesting artwork the Star Trek fandom was doing, interesting panels and discussions, the first thing you will see visually in these newspapers are, hey, look, people in weird costumes. Well, in the 90s, the furries had to deal with the birth of the 24-hour news cycle. So when you didn't have any news to report on, what would the local news do? Hey, there's a furry convention in town. Let's go report on it. Hey, look at these weirdos in these weird outfits. Yeah, they're kind of weird. So the furries kind of got the same treatment the Star Trek fans did. And because of that, the furries kind of got attacked and ridiculed. Now, I talked to a lot of old furries during this period for my book. I'm just going to kind of generalize the story. I'm sure you guys will chime in with your own recollections, but because these early furry cons were being attacked heinously, unfairly by the media and by the press, a lot of the furry cons started to deny press from coming to their events. They said, please don't bring media. If you're a media, please don't take pictures. They told attendees, please do not give interviews to media. Do not share stuff with media. Thank you. And because of that, the media responded by saying, why are these furries so secretive? Why won't they let us into these conventions? So by closing themselves up to kind of protect themselves, the media just started to spin more stories about what was happening in these furry cons. So we got this crazy, so furry cons really became their own branch by necessity, because a lot of these small furry cons were too afraid to even, because most cons, the science fiction, comic, and anime cons, would share their volunteers. So you might not be a fan of science fiction, but an anime con staffer might staff a science fiction con. Local cons will have local staffers. The furries, some of these furry cons were a little paranoid of having outside folks help staff their cons. So you started seeing an interesting development where you had core staffers from these furry cons travel from city to city to help these different cons. So furries choosing staffers and volunteers from their own circles basically paved way for their own unique branch. And so actually, when I first started attending furry cons in the late 2000s, I noticed that the furry cons were very, very similar to the science fiction cons in the 90s. It's not that they didn't really evolve, but because the furry cons were so used to running like the science fiction con in the 90s, even up until the mid-2010s, you had a lot of furry cons still adapting the old school science fiction model, because the science fiction con model works for cons that are under about 4,000 attendees. So these small furry cons still kind of adapted this model. Now furries are being more accepted, which is great, but it wouldn't come about until a decade later. So what was happening in the other conventions around this time? Well, this is where we have a period known as a comic boom and bust. It looks like I'm running out of time on panel, so I'm going to try to quickly summarize this. All you need to know is that there became a big market from collecting comics. And one of the biggest groups to capitalize on this was Wizard Magazine, which would sell magazines, which catalyzed the price of comics in the back. And Wizard Magazine were like, hey, a lot of people collect these comics at conventions. Let's go buy a convention. So Wizard Magazine bought one of the oldest comic cons around this time, Chicago Comic Con. And basically, this is where the pro-con model started really, really taking off. So what happened? Like I was saying, most conventions were kind of portrayed negatively during these periods. You had negative portrayals of the Star Trek cons. You had negative portrayals of the furry cons. Like I think someone mentioned the CSI episode that kind of mocked the furry cons and completely misrepresented it. Like, single-track programming? Come on, that wouldn't work. But so when did the conception of conventions went from being something that was niche for nerds to being something that was accepted by the general populace? Well, there is no one specific idea. I have my own theory, and my theory is looking at the ticket numbers of Comic-Con sales and looking at the dates. And my theory is when Robert Downey Jr. went to San Diego Comic-Con to promote Iron Man is when we started to see the shift in geek and nerd culture becoming insular to something accepting and popular to the popular audience. Now, not to be rude to the guests of honor and guests that, and actors that you normally see at conventions around this time, but a lot of the actors you would visit at these conventions were washed up movie star actors, TV show actors, at best B-list actors. And most people don't even know comic, even the most famous comic book artists and writers of the times, most people, the general public wouldn't know. But Robert Downey Jr., hey, he is a movie star. He is a Hollywood actor. And what do people like doing? They like flocking to see movie stars. That's why you have these star tours. And the fact that you could go to a convention and now a movie star, a Hollywood actor is there, that changes the entire game. And while before Robert Downey Jr.'s appearance at San Diego Comic-Con, you could buy a ticket to Comic-Con the day of and just walk in, all of a sudden you see Comic-Con tickets selling out before the con, to the point where Comic-Con tickets sell out in seconds of opening. And this is where I started tracking the shift, because you started to see a boom in all these convention businesses. Comic-Con International, Left Field Media, Informer, like I said, Wizard World, all these businesses started forming around running conventions. And you started to see people trying to profit off geek culture. So Loot Crate, Funko Pop, all this type of geek culture started booming, post this period. And it also helped that the MCU started around this time as well. Now, okay, it looks like about 5 minutes left, and then I'll take questions and answers, but let me just quickly go through the last few parts, and then we will move to the Q&A section. So let's quickly talk about bronies. So why am I talking about bronies for a bit? Because I would say bronies also came about from the same situation that brought about the Trekkies and the furries. So now that like the birth of local media with the Star Trek fandom and the rise of local media when furries came about, bronies came about during a time of instant media, online media, online news cycles. And when you see a bunch of adult males liking a show that was made for little girls, of course the media is going to jump on it. The brony fandom was essentially born through mostly millennials who are really supportive of Lauren Faust. Lauren Faust was an animator for a lot of the shows they grew up on. Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends, Dexter's Laboratory, Powerpuff Girls, Cats Don't Dance. So a lot of, an Iron Giant, of course. So a lot of movies and shows that millennials love growing up with as kids, they were nostalgic for. So of course, when one of their favorite animators come about with a new show, let's watch it. You know, My Little Pony, okay, that's kind of weird, but she's a great animator. Let's go out and support her. And boom, you got the birth of the brony fandom. Long story short, Purple Tinker took the model of the Science Fiction Con and the model of the Furry Con, combined them together, and boom, you got BronyCon. The science fiction Star Trek model, basically you invited the actors from the Star Trek show to be a guest at your convention. The problem was, while the Star Trek show had a lot of the generations to choose from the original series, Next Generation, all the way to the new age, J.J. Abrams and Discovery shows to pull actors from, My Little Pony only focused on one generation of his franchise. 1, 2, and 3 were not counted. Only Generation 4 was the one that people most specifically looked at. So when you had Purple Tinker having to deal with a show that only had 6 main characters, 4 voice actresses, it changed the situation. So all these BronyCons started to fight over all these different VAs, to the point where you had almost like 50 BronyCons happening in the country at the same every year. It was crazy. They were all fighting over the same VAs, and this came ahead at Las Pegasus Unicon, where this con almost crashed and burned, but the Brony fandom united and kind of saved this convention, and we're like, okay, we cannot let this situation happen ever again. Let's narrow down our cons, and let's focus on treating our guests happy. And this is where we get the birth of VIP relations, also known as VIPR, which is a specific department meant for treating the welfare of the guests of honor very, very importantly. I think as Uncle Kage explained on one of his during his history panel yesterday, how conventions used to treat guests around this time, where they kind of shell them from the airport all in like a van and then brought them, march them around to different panels, made them sit, do a lot of signings, and then shell them back to the airport and send them home. Most people would be exhausted, frustrated, never wanting to come back to the con again. The bronies with the VIPR model really wanted to make sure that the guests weren't overworked. They made sure to treat these events like vacations for these guests, so guests would want to come back over and over again. And the VIP model started to be adapted to other cons around this time. Bronies also popularized the use of pronoun ribbons, gender-neutral bathrooms, and communication tags, which started to make their way to other cons. Furries also now use communication pronoun tags and gender-neutral bathrooms. But you start to see this entire boom of people trying to profit off the cons. Okay, so we have a bad period. We had something called the Sad Puppies, a conservative voting bloc to try to get conservative authors voted on during the Hugo Awards. This culminated during a period where we had Gamergate, Comicgate, Me Too, cosplays consent situation became really big around this time. It's not consent, became really big around this time. And a lot of stories of comic book artists harassing female cosplayers or trying to sleep with female fans became very, very big. And boom, you had this entire period where during the Me Too movement and cancel culture, all these cons started to weed out a lot of the issues that they had. obviously, within the brony and furry fandoms, I would say the most progressive, liberal of the fandoms. They had to deal with the issue, Wired or not season or fandom. So a lot of the furries and bronies had to figure out a way to, you know, get rid of the Nazis from within the fandom. And it's ironic that the media always attacks bronies and furries for having these Nazis and alt-right elements in the fandom, when actually they are the most progressive of the fandoms, and the fandoms that should be kind of weeding these people out are not. For example, most people don't really understand the inherent fascist roots of the science fiction genre, made popularized in Iron Dream by Nomad Spinrad. You can also read a great essay called Stormtroopers by Michael Moorcock on that issue. The superhero genre also has this kind of fascist power play. Obviously, you had creators like Jack Kirby, Jewish creators, trying to make superheroes for another thing, but they've been misinterpreted to being, you know, wish fulfillment power fantasies. And of course, anime kind of did have its roots with Axis propaganda during the World Wars. And that became an issue because you had a lot of people cosplaying as Italia characters during this period, which was really, really bad. So you had that issue. Now, this leads to the period when I was saying you had these fan-run cons and these volunteer-run cons start to come about. Now, the issues of volunteer-run cons is you get what I coined the Vandy cons. The Vandy cons are normally founded by a founder who ends up being con chair for life. If the con chair for life has to step down, they end up becoming a board member for life. And you basically have these cons, volunteer-run cons, founded by one individual. If that individual ends up being problematic, there's no way to separate that individual from the con, so the entire con has to fall if they fall. You also have people buying their ways into cons, becoming a con chair of a con, and becoming con chair for life, and that kind of caused issues. Like, it could be good or bad. Like, it seems like Uncle Kage is doing a really good job with Anthrocon. Charlie's doing a good job for the Corgi Event Pony Conventions. But then you do have issues where people do found cons and kind of run it like their own personal, you know, place to mingle with the guests of honor. On the other hand, you have the pro cons, the creation con, the wizard worlds, Reed Pops, that ran things like, you know, like a sterile autograph factory. A lot of old guard calls them cattle cons, because you basically just shove attendees from one line to another to another to wait for exclusive merch, to wait for an autograph, to wait for exclusive merch, to wait for a panel. So you start to see people not enjoying these cattle con things, to the point where you start to see almost all these cons, volunteer run cons being bought up by these industries. So, for example, Emerald City Comic Con was bought by Reed Pop, while World City Comic Con was bought up by Left Field Media. See this time and again. Then we had the pandemic happen, and this is the period where we are now. During the pandemic, we started to see a shift to online conventions. Some of the first, because bronies were online fandom. They were kind of born online. The furry cons were kind of running virtual cons before this pandemic happened. But when the pandemic happened, because they were so used to running online cons, they ended up being really the first when the pandemic started to do online cons. Shout out to Pony Fest Online, which really became the template for most of these online cons to implement. My friend Roof, who's an artist, started a virtual dealers hall to help artists who were displaced during the pandemic. Naturally, these cons started to evolve through Discord, Zooms, and VR streams. The VR, specifically the furry cons, really were great at. The online furry cons that really pushed the boundaries of what VRs could do, including recreating the convention centers like we seen with Anthrocon, basically recreating the convention center, having streams online, having virtual dealers hall, really, really great. The anime cons and comic cons also try to move in this direction, but it's ironic because, like I was saying, these anime cons, science cons, fiction cons, and comic cons kind of are more run by corporate older entities who don't really know the online system, so they had to hire other groups to kind of run their cons. The furry and brony cons that shifted online, they could still be run by their core staff because they're really savvy in internet and technology. So I think this is where we see FurryCons and BronyCons really outshining the convention scene with how good the quality these virtual cons are compared to what the comic cons and anime cons were putting out. So yeah, that kind of leads us to today. And I think that concludes the history portion of my panel. Oh, we are overflowing. I apologize. It looks like I ran over. Apologize for that, but that concludes the history portion of my panel. I'm doing the So You Want to Be a Con Artist panel at 7 tonight, if you guys want to stick around for the life of vending at conventions, how to vend at conventions. And with that, thank you guys very much. If you want to help support me, go to conhistory.com/shop, and you could purchase stuff that would help me out. You could also email me and contribute stories. If you have any interesting stories you want to talk about from the convention scene, feel free to check that out. If not, feel free to, I have a bunch of interviews I'll be hopefully posting on my YouTube channel, Icon History. And with that, thank you guys very much for coming to my panel. I don't know if any staff are here. If we're able to stay here or have a breakout room where I could take Q&As, that would be great. If not, if you guys do have any questions, feel free to email me at conhistory@gmail.com or ping me at conhistory on Twitter. And with that, thank you guys very much for coming to my panel. Feel free to check out my my booth in the virtual dealers hall. And I hope you guys enjoy the rest of your time here at AnthroCon Online. Thank you very much. And I guess with that, if you guys have any questions, put them in the chat and I could try to answer them. All right. Is that the chat? Oh, index of furry cons. Okay. Since it's a audio call, if you guys want to do a free form discussion, I could do that until they kick us off then. So I guess any questions or any comments that you have before I end the panel?
Yeah. Sure. I'm not sure if these count as conventions, but there are companies that who are like publishers or game developers. They're kind of doing their own like events, mm-hmm. like Blizzard, Digital Extremes doing their TennoCon. Disney doing their D23, and so a lot of these.
So I actually have them right here. So the gaming cons, like E3 and stuff, I kind of branch out because they come from the trade show position. Obviously, games come from the electronics industry. So the electronics industry started with the electronics trade shows. Trade shows, I would say, are a completely different animal. But because of how successful the comic cons and anime cons were in the 90s and 2000s, a lot of these trade shows that were specifically gaming trade shows started to shift their model to become more in line with the convention model, which is why I branch these trade shows out specifically on their own branch. And like you said, D23 Expo, yeah, these are attempts to try to emulate the convention model because they know this is an important place to announce, to make new announcements. So instead, like for example, Disney, instead of giving press to a convention they don't own by making announcements for their Marvel and Star Wars movies, why not have our own convention that we run, own, and organize to announce these things? So yeah, you start seeing a lot of these publisher-specific conventions pop up. They aren't big enough that I would say they constitute their own branch because they are hybrids of all the existing models that came before, and they didn't bring any new distinguishing feature that would kind of make them essentially a new mutation in the con line. But I would kind of classify them in either the gaming con line or the multimedia con line.
But I think it's interesting that these publishers thought to like create their own conventions instead of doing events at an existing one or at an existing trade show.
Yeah, like I said, it gives them something to control. So they could control the announcements and all the press will have to come there. So it's very unique. And I also think before the pandemic happened, I was kind of predicting what the future of cons would be. I always thought cons would naturally become digital cons because of how social media is interacting now. Like I said, before then, the only place to meet these big list actors and your favorite artists was to come to these events. Now with the advent of Twitter, we can now basically tweet something to an actor and he might tweet off an angry reply within minutes. So I think that definitely changed the game. Instead of waiting to see your favorite actors at these conventions, you can now interact with them now. So because of the pandemic, I'm not sure how cons are going to come back. I think they will, but I think digital cons are definitely here to stay. And the pandemic produced a lot of strong digital cons to prove that these digital cons don't need to go away, that even when in-person cons come back, we're going to be keeping a lot of these digital cons on hand. Okay, any other comments or questions? And this is, if not, let me link my thing here. All right, I think that's it then. Go to Con History. I'm sure if you guys have any stories you want to tell me, any corrections you want to make, if you have any old con photos I would love to include in my book and my virtual museum, please send me an email at conhistory@gmail.com. And with that, thank you very much for coming to my panel. Stop by my other panel at 7 p.m. for vending at conventions. And with that, just enjoy your time here at AntoCon.